move on to case number five, and that is case number 2001-3000, United States of America versus Carlos C. Knox. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Thomas N. Koeg. This is my partner, Karen Intermill. We are third-year law students at the University of Notre Dame. We are here under the advisement and counsel of attorney Robert J. Palmer, and with the permission of this honorable court. I will be addressing the sentencing guideline issue and the 404B evidence issue. Defendant Knox asked this court to remand for resentencing under a proper application of the United States Sentencing Guidelines Manual. Under that manual, Chapter 3 mandates grouping of closely related offenses. Knox was convicted of two counts under 21 U.S.C. 841. Those counts should have been grouped by the district court. Further, Chapter 5 provides that multiple counts may be sentenced consecutively if those penalties need to be run consecutively to reach the statutory maximum.
To reach the sentence that is otherwise prescribed by the guidelines, which is a different point.
Sentence prescribed by the guidelines?
Well, you know, obviously the guidelines can't prescribe a sentence that exceeds the statutory maximum, and there's going to be a statutory maximum on each count, right?
Well, it's our argument that you must first determine what the statutory maximum is in order to comport with Apprendi versus New Jersey. To that end, we ask this court to find that the statutory maximum must be set before the district court begins its examination of how the defendant should be sentenced. In this instance, Knox was convicted of two counts. We ask this court to find that Knox's maximum statutory penalty should be 360 months under 21 U.S.C. 841 because Chapter 3 of the guidelines mandates grouping. Grouping of those counts is referred to also in Chapter 1, and I quote from the guidelines. The guidelines treat a three-count indictment, each count of which charges the sale of 100 grams of heroin or theft of $10,000, the same as a single-count indictment charging a sale of 300 grams of heroin or $30,000.
But if the sales are separate, I mean, the guidelines go on to talk about this. That's part of the real offense sentencing aspect of the guidelines to the extent they have it. Not all sales are the same offense. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't, as the guidelines point out. If you have one sale in 1 year and 9 months later you have another sale, then they're different events.
They may be different events, Your Honor, but
not subject to grouping.
We argue that they should be subject to grouping because here they are involved in a course of conduct. And the course of conduct by the defendant Knox is that of selling crack cocaine for a living, unfortunately. And that is clear on the record. But by virtue of that testimony by the defendant, we argue that there should be no question as to the grouping of the counts. And if that is taken as true, then the government should not be allowed to simply charge multiple counts and run them consecutively, therefore really never implicating Apprendi's mandate that conduct such as drug amount and the perjury charge that was also brought by the government be proved beyond a reasonable doubt in front of a jury to extend the sentence beyond a statutory maximum.
If we don't agree with you on grouping, and one of his counts is January 6, 1999, and the other is June 13, 2000, there's a 20-year statutory maximum for these small amounts of crack. So that gives the district judge up to 480 months if he runs it consecutively in order to achieve a reasonable punishment. He's way under that.
Well, we agree with you, Your Honor. If the counts are not grouped, then this issue is not raised. Because if the conduct is sufficiently independent of one another, as you point out, if the
right.
district court judge finds that one count happened 3, 4, 5 years earlier, and then the next count later, they're not connected in a course of conduct and should not be grouped, then this sentence presents no problem under Apprendi, and the issues we raised are irrelevant. However, that is a main contention of Knox's argument, that they should be grouped by virtue of his own testimony, that indeed this is a course of conduct and that the charge offense type sentencing request that the government gave here prescribes a sentence that runs afoul of Apprendi by some 60 months. It's also shown in the record that even if the district court attributed the amount of drugs shown in at trial to Knox, he would still only be exposed to a sentence, assuming grouping applies, of 360 months. However, the district court judge chose not to examine the amount of drugs attributed to Knox by testimony heard in open court, but rather called in Agent Nadolsky, who recounted testimony by one Kaleem Wilson attributing over 13,000 kilograms of marijuana equivalent to Mr. Knox. That finding, in conjunction with a perjury finding that was used as a sentencing enhancement, raised the base offense level of 38 and exposed Mr. Knox to a sentence of up to 480 months, of which he was given 420. That sentence, as we argue, is beyond the statutory maximum that should be found if grouping is deemed appropriate in this case.
Thank you.
Are there no further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court? My name is Karen Intermill, and I'll be addressing the conflict of interest and the trial court's duty to inquire into that conflict. Mr. Knox, immediately upon learning of a possible conflict of interest between his trial counsel and one of the government's main witnesses against him, notified the district court. At that point, the district court had a mandatory constitutional duty to make an on-the-record inquiry into that conflict.
Now, why was the district court obligated to conduct a hearing on the conflict of interest question when there seems to be no actual evidence that Mr. Knox's trial counsel ever did represent Mr. Patton?
The government's brief with the appendix that this court allowed does indicate that he had another counselor or two counselors during this trial, but it does not indicate, and neither does the record, whether or not Mr. Knox's trial attorney ever represented this witness at any other time, in any other proceedings, or had anything else to do with this witness. Additionally, there is some evidence in the record which lends credence to Mr. Knox's allegation, and that is the cross-examination of this witness.
Well, that's just because you don't think it was a good cross-examination, but I agree with Judge Rovner, especially since this is the same district judge. I mean, district judges, as well as Court of Appeals judges, remember the lawyers who are in front of them. So I suspect Judge Gilbert knew perfectly well that the witness was represented by different people.
If that is true, the district court still failed to make any finding on the record so that this court or any other reviewing body could look at that record and make that determination. Judge Gilbert probably sees many, many defendants with the same lawyers, especially as this was court-appointed counsel who tend to have many cases, and may not have been able off the top of his head to say, this lawyer was with this child at this time with this client.
But the docket sheet's a matter of public record, though. I mean, I was surprised that you wanted to push this point, given that it seems there's really nothing behind it.
But Mr. Knox's constitutional rights were still violated when the court failed to make an on-the-record inquiry. The United States Supreme Court and this circuit have held that the possibility of a conflict mandates an inquiry into
the
matter.
So all a defendant has to do, no matter how frivolously, is file a statement with the court, and the court's got to stop everything and hold a hearing?
Well, there are 2 points that question raises, Your Honor. In this case, Mr. Knox, his motion was completely ignored by the district court and given no attention, so that there's no basis for whether or not we know whether he was frivolously or not. Most defendants at this point would have an attorney who would file that motion, and that would have made a difference in this case. The second point is the district court is in a position to spend 5 minutes of its time talking to the parties involved and to make an on-the-record determination that would clearly once and for all establish whether or not there was a conflict.
But
no factual support for this at all. So even if you were to win, what do you get? You go back to the district court. District court spends the 5 minutes you're talking about and says this Patton was never represented by this woman. So what's the purpose of this?
The purpose, Your Honor, is that the judicial system must not only protect the innocent but the guilty, and the appearance of justice is very important to the proper functioning of the judicial system. If people don't believe their constitutional rights will be violated, will be respected by district courts, whether or not it seems to be a minor matter, then it undermines the integrity of the judicial system.
Now, Ms. Interval, in the absence of such evidence, would you like to withdraw the conflict argument so as to preserve Mr. Knox's ability to raise it in a Section 2255 motion at a later date should further evidence turn up?
At this point, Your Honor, we're not actually, I see my time's up, I'll finish briefly. We're not actually arguing that there was a conflict, and we're not actually arguing anything regarding the trial attorney himself. We're only arguing that the district court failed to, in its obligations to Mr. Knox by holding the inquiry. We're not respecting any actual conflict of interest claim at this time. Thank you.
To please the court and brother counsel and my esteemed students, first of all,
wait a minute.
Are talk
they
of a conflict of interest.
Judge,
let's take 5 minutes to.
I have a. I think you raised a question which is really troubling, and that is, Mr. Knox filed a whole slew of, I count them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pro se motions, which Judge Gilbert heard or struck from the record, and the one that is before this court right now is entitled, or deals with ineffective assistance. And they're treading on very dangerous ground here, and I'm not sure that that under the circumstances that the question of whether or not this really wants to be addressed by the defendant was answered definitively, and it carries with it far-flung, far-reaching ramifications for the defendant.
Well, in Mr. Hogan's one-minute rebuttal,
okay.
I'll ask him.
Great, okay. Let me just respond briefly to the arguments which were made by both of the law students. Number one, paragraph 25 of the PSR says the counts were groups. And I think we clearly have a little semantic problem of misunderstanding perhaps what grouping is as opposed to consecutive sentences. And obviously, under the Apprendi decision, all we're concerned about is do we go over the 240-year, 240-month Freudian slip, statutory maximum for each of those counts. And as the court has already noted, we are significantly below that when the counts are taken consecutively, as is required by the guidelines. 404B was not addressed, and I just want to briefly point out that the only objection which was made doesn't really go to the question of whether or not the evidence was cumulative, whether or not the evidence was prejudicial, or whether or not the evidence was inflammatory. It was kind of a quasi-objection where the defense at trial said, Judge, I know this is coming in, but it's not charged conduct. And Judge Gilbert said, it's coming in. And that's the only objection, really, with regard to the 404B material, and that went only to the tape of the buy, which occurred about a month before, and it was a 404B buy, that occurred before the count one by the same confidential source. So we've got temporal proximity, we've got routine patterns, we're showing the relationship of the confidential source to the defendant, and is clearly competent for purposes of showing knowledge and intent, and Judge Gilbert did in fact admonish every time 404B came in, admonished the jury as to that.
Let me take you back to drug quantity for an instant,
yes,
because Mr. Knox's brief indicates that the district court's drug quantity calculation was based in part on testimony of Agent Nadolsky, who in turn recounted the proffer of Mr. Wilson. How was Judge Gilbert able to assess Mr. Wilson's credibility without having seen or heard Mr. Wilson?
Well, Mr. Wilson, of course, was a defendant in Judge Gilbert's courtroom. He wasn't there for the purposes of that sentencing hearing. His proffer statement was offered as one part of a lot of evidence with regards to the calculation of the relevant conduct. And I don't believe, and I'm harking back, this is not something that I have readily at my hands, but I don't believe that there was really any issue in terms of calculation of relevant conduct that was raised at sentencing. But the court is well familiar with Mr. Wilson. I don't think I really have much else to say in light of the proximity of lunch. If the court has any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Are you all going to Burkhart? What's the story? Okay.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Turek, you used your time, but I'm going to give you a minute. So come on up.
Your Honors, may I begin? We are not challenging, definitively on the record, we are not challenging the effectiveness of counsel. Rather, we are asking simply for the hearing to be conducted on the record to affirm whether or not there was a conflict. And really, the record is somewhat thin as to whether or not there was a conflict simply because the trial court did not make it part of the record. I would imagine a simple statement of, I don't believe you, Mr. Knox, there is no conflict,
the problem
would have sufficed.
If you want to say this, you have to withdraw that argument.
We do have to withdraw that.
Seems to me.
Then we
I
do.
Mean, I'm not supposed to give you advice, but...
Then we, if the court views it as a challenge to counsel, then we will withdraw the argument and preserve it for 55. I'm sorry. If there are no further questions.
Well, then you certainly have the thanks of the court, Mr. Gohig and Ms. Intermill and Mr. Palmer. You were appointed to this case for your vigorous defense of your client. And thanks to Mr. Moore as well. And the case will be taken under advisement.